This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Christmas, everybody's feeling funny. No one's making joyful sounds.
Cranberry sauce ain't steamed
in. The lineups at the bathroom are longer than at the mall. Everybody's meeting intense. The Christmas virus.
Good day.
Bonjour.
How you doing, partner?
Welcome to I Read the News Day, oh boy.
Or IRTN for short.
That's Keith Gottschalk, the Yank from Iowa, the bleeding heart of America.
And that's Matt Adams, if you can't tell from the accent or the attitude, is also an American and a Canadian.
And on today's show, it's all things liberal. We have the Liberal Convention, we have liberals coming up here, and then we've got the Liberal Critique of Iraq.
But our first segment is Below the Fold, some news you may have missed in under, hopefully, a few minutes. Start out with an example of an incident that would have been treated differently in Canada than the States. Two employees of the city of Boise's municipal skating rink have been fired for making a midnight fast food run to a local Burger King in a pair of Zambonis November 10th. The squat rubber-tired vehicles, which have a top speed of about 5 miles an hour, you all know that up in Canada, drove 1.5 miles in all. The Zamboni operators, both Temp City employees, had to negotiate at least one intersection with a traffic light in their late-night creep from Idaho Ice World. Parks Department Director Jim Hall said they were fired immediately. When we interviewed them, they didn't seem to be too concerned about it. I don't think they understood the seriousness of it. Well, perhaps they were Canadians.
An American has a new export to England. The Guardian has reported that 9 British schools are or are considering using U.S.-made creationist intelligent design material. 89 schools returned the feedback postcard to the United States group Truth in Science, with 59 positive responses. Last year, a judge in Dover, Pennsylvania, ruled that intelligent design could not be taught in science lessons, declaring that, quote, intelligent design is a religious view, a mere relabeling of creationism and not a scientific theory, unquote. Creationists may believe the Earth is only 1,000 years old, but the British government wasn't born yesterday and has made it clear that intelligent design materials, quote, are not appropriate to support the science curriculum, unquote. It should not be science lessons. Maybe Truth in Science should create a new attempt to put religion into science.
Kelpie Wilson reports in Truth Out, the White House has begun closing the Environmental Protection Agency's research libraries to the public and to its own staff, cementing Bush's reputation as an usher of a new dark age. The EPA's professional staff objected strongly, insisting that closing the libraries would hamstring them in their jobs. In a letter to Congress protesting the closures, public employees said, quote, we believe that this budget cut is just one of many Bush administration initiatives to reduce the effectiveness of the U.S. EPA and to demoralize its employees, end quote. Why does this surprise anyone? Can't have pertinent data about global climate change and corporate polluters available. Might be bad for business, you know.
And the Washington Post reports that the AK-47 machine gun is now so cheap it can be bought in many countries for less than the cost of a live victim. The Post reports that, quote, the AK is responsible for about 250,000 deaths per year. It is the firearm of choice for up to 50 legitimate Canadian armies and countless fighting forces from Africa and the Middle East, Central America, and Los Angeles, unquote. The report reported that the CIA promoted the AK with over $2 billion of money given to Afghanistan for weapons and resistance to the Soviets. The inventor of the AK, Mr. Kalashnikov himself, took off. Told the Guardian 2002, quote, I wish I had invented a lawnmower, unquote.
Here's an Iraq story you won't hear on the American media. Peter Tatchell and Euroconet report Saddam may have been a bad man, but gays and lesbians could at least walk the streets of Baghdad without fear of being murdered by Islamic fundamentalists when he was in power. On November 9th, 5 gay men, Amjad 27, Rafid 29, Hassan 24, Iman 19, and Ali 21, were abducted and now feared dead. All were members of Iraq's clandestine gay rights movement, Iraq LGBT. For the last few months, they have been documenting the killing of lesbians and gays, relaying details of the barbaric homophobic murders to the outside world, and providing safe houses and support to queers fleeing the death squads. Earlier in June this year, Islamic death squads burst into the home of two lesbians in the city of Najaf. They shot them dead, slashed their throats, and also murdered a young child the lesbians had rescued from the sex trade. The two women, both in their mid-30s, were members of Iraqi LGBT. Do you think the American military command cares what happens to them?
And finally, McDonald's restaurant has submitted a 55-page patent application in Europe and the United States on how to make a sandwich. Metro has reported that McDonald's wants intellectual property rights to help its sandwiches look and taste the same in all restaurants. Lawrence Smith Higgins of the United Kingdom Patent Office said, quote, McDonald's or anyone else cannot get retrospective exclusive rights to making a sandwich. They might have a novel device, but it could be quite easy for someone to make a sandwich in a similar way without infringing their claims. Quote. McDonald's, quote, these applications are not intended to prevent anyone from using previous methods for making sandwiches, unquote. The application includes descriptions of a, quote, sandwich delivery tool and bread opponent. The Earl could be proud.
Hey, I used to try and make egg muffins at home, but then again, I made them at McDonald's because that was my first job. It's fun.
And if you reveal the patented method for making that, you could be facing a lawsuit, Keith. So be quiet about the left-hand crossover cheese wrap, egg dump, or whatever you did.
Yeah, really. All right. Well, we got a lot to talk about today. First of all, right now going on in Montreal is the Liberal Party convention, or who's going to be hopefully the next Prime Minister of Canada. Is that going a bit far there, Matt?
Well, I think for a lot of Americans don't realize, I think, first of all, like the Liberal Party here, like if you had a party for the Liberal Party of the United States, it'd be like calling it the Communist Party. Mm. You know, they wouldn't get any votes. But here, of course, the Liberal Party is more like centrist Democrats at best.
Right.
And they very, very likely to retake power and a huge political machine. And people have their eyes on it because the Tories are weak right now, at least they're a lot weaker than they have been. And the Liberals are doing quite well in the polls, and that's without a leader.
Mm-hmm.
So if they pull off a leader, they're doing great. And then if they pull off even a center-left leader, then that's going to really hurt the NDP.
Well, let me ask you this, then. You're up there. You know the people running. They're sort of like a big two, a two that maybe have something of a shot, and then there's four behind them that are acknowledged to have no chance whatsoever. Michael Ignatieff comes in as the odds-on favorite, but has stumbled badly after he opened his mouth about Quebec nationhood. You can talk a little bit about how that's affected his chances.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, he sort of opened this up, and then the debate moved beyond him, and the Tories tried to gain control of it by making this proposal last week, recognize Quebec as a nation within a united Canada. And at first, the Bloc was opposed to that, but then they flipped around and voted for it, so it passed, you know, with overwhelming numbers, because everybody thinks it helps them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Liberals then were able to duck the issue at the convention. So I'm not sure it's going to hurt him that bad. I think more attention on the war,
mm-hmm.
Which he's been a chicken hawk for. Plus, he's been, you know, a professor at Harvard for so many years and sort of parachuting in. He has very weak numbers for the second ballot. So, you know, if you don't survive the first ballot, and if you don't get a winner, then it goes to the second ballot and people are not committed to vote for who they act as delegates for.
Now, there was a movement yesterday. Somebody was circulating a pamphlet telling people that if they couldn't vote their conscience on the first ballot, not to vote, and therefore they would not be further bound, and anybody on the second can vote for anybody on the second ballot. Ignatieff's people privately, according to the Canadian press, blamed rival Bob Rae for the underhanded tactics, which I don't know if Rae's folks are quite that savvy enough, but
yeah, his experience doesn't show that he's like if you're that clever, then maybe you would have done better as premier.
Oh yes, I'm going to name drop right here. Ignatieff actually, his team held a party for journalists, according to Canadian press, and they were handing out, among other things, copies of the 1994 book entitled Rae Days, The Rise and Folly of the NDP, which they don't mention, was by rabble columnist Thomas Walkham. And I happened to be holding a copy of said book right in my hot little hand that I bought while I was in Toronto 2 weeks ago. And I didn't notice until I got it home it was actually signed by Walkham. Be that not here, not there, but it does seem amazing that when you talk about Bob Rae, There was so much that went on when his premiership crashed and burned in Ontario. I think it's a testament to in Canadian politics. I mean, I guess if the Americans can rehabilitate certain people, Richard Nixon or whatever, but never back to a position of power, Ray seems to be well on his way to being rehabilitated, even if he doesn't win the nomination as the Liberal Party leader. To get this far after what happened to him back in the 90s really seems to kind of amaze me. Is that indicative of Canadian politics in general?
Well, I asked some friends of mine that because, you know, I've only been here for like 10 years. And I don't have the long view, but this seems to me to be sort of a glorified Carter syndrome. Because, you know, Jimmy Carter left office and he hit 29% at one point approval rating, which Bush is flirting with but hasn't hit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then now he's loved by like 80% of people. Everybody thinks he's a better ex-president than he was president.
Right.
Bob Rae is pretty much vilified for his position as the premier, but you know, then he ran the Air India inquiry, and he's sort of seen as more of an elder statesman, Rick, you know, and he could pull it off. And it seems to be that, I mean, at one point, we had Mulroney apparently was below 10% in approval rating, you know, and I'm sure he's above that now. So it seems to me that the extremes, they're very forgiving, or we're very forgiving.
You mean there are actually people right now in Canada above 10% that have warm thoughts of Brian Mulroney?
Well, I would think so.
Okay.
I mean, you know, no president would ever go below 10%.
You would think not.
No, a president could go on national television and kill puppies for sport and then bowl with their dead bodies. Then maybe they'd go to 15. But they'd be like, but it's the president, you know, those dogs are going to bite him, or, you know, but here they'll be like, you know what, you really stink. But then there also seems to be a bit of this forgiveness thing, and I think Ray or Dion could come up the center second or third ballot.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Right now we have Jared Kennedy, who is supposedly in third place ahead of Stephen Dion, who I actually think would probably be...
I have 1.5% on superdelegates. Very light.
So they're very, very close. There's some speculation that Ignatieff or Ray might loan votes to Jared Kennedy to keep him in third place ahead of Dion, who would be dropped off the ballot after the trailing four withdraw after a first ballot. For Americans, this is kind of hard to comprehend. I had to read a little bit about it myself, but...
I'm still weak on this.
Yeah, what is the fear with Dion? I happen to think that when I read Dion's background and his biography, I mean, you got to appreciate somebody who was raised, you know, in a very Quebecois family, who turned into a Federalist after a five-hour rum and cola session with his family, according to his biography. I mean, here's a guy I think would be, as someone from Quebec and a Federalist, would be a perfect compromise candidate. What do you think is the fear of trying to keep him down in this race?
Well, they see his numbers as being very, very strong for the second or third ballot. He's pulling very high as the second choice.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to get rid of him as the second choice. And in some ways, it's like, you know, they're going to have a temporary line to take him down. Because if it goes to a second round, then he could pull this off. But, I mean, we had... there's a long tradition of liberals from Quebec.
Right.
Federalists from Quebec. Now, he's probably the most green of all the candidates, and that's good, but...
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right, and I think he's in a long line of politicians that, you know, certainly have ascended to the Prime Minister, just the 24 suspects, who have been Federalist from Quebec for the Liberal Party, and I think that in an area where I still think that there are party insiders who are not comfortable with Bob Rae, and I think there are party insiders who are not comfortable with Michael Ignatieff. And again, what do you think about Kennedy? I mean, he came out as very against the whole idea of Quebec nationhood right off the bat. Do you think he's got the support to maybe pull this out?
I think I'd be surprised to see Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, I actually find it easier to lay odds in American races than I do in Canadian races.
Now,
it's hard to get the numbers that I'd like to see.
Weird things have happened in party conventions.
Pardon?
I mean, very weird things have happened in party conventions, certainly. And there's a lot more unpredictability, it seems to be, in Canadian party politics than in American party politics. So, yeah, I mean, you could throw these four names in a hat, and any one of them could come up and under several different scenarios. I mean, is that a true statement?
It seems to me that it's harder to handicap.
Yeah.
Some of that, I think, is probably our own ignorance of Canadian politics. You know, I've only been studying it for 10 or so years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's only so many conventions one can look through. But, Kennedy, you know, tends to be a fairly progressive guy, short of his position on Quebec.
But right.
No Liberal Party is going to come out in support of, or any party is going to come out, you know, outside of Quebec in support of sovereignty. So most progressives actually do support that position.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's a whole other show.
My favorite, my choice is Kenny Dryden, who is currently fifth.
Oh, yeah? For the hockey?
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand this. According to the Canadian press, yesterday he was waiting for his wife's arrival. He was waiting for his wife to arrive to stage his grand entrance. In the meantime, he reportedly wandered the halls quietly without an entourage. I mean, this man is one of the greatest goalies, Hockey Hall of Famer, you know, for six years with the Canadians, and it's like, I don't know. Maybe it's just a different thing.
He's not going to be prime minister.
He's not going to be prime
minister. Visit him in the Hall of Fame.
I think he'd be a great guy. But I guess there's just not this devotion to sports figures like you might see in the States with not only sports figures but movie stars and things of that nature. Is it the contention that he just hasn't had enough seasoning in the system yet, or lacks some other type of gravitas? What's your view on that?
I don't know enough about that in terms of sort of his popularity. He's certainly probably, he doesn't lack for name recognition.
Right.
You know, Montreal Canadiens, goalie in the Stanley Cup, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. But, you know, he was supposed to set up the national daycare program.
Right, right.
With Martin and everything, but, you know, there was a lot of talk and not a lot of action happening under that. You know, the Liberals in their last campaign kept saying, well, we're going to set up daycare, and people are like, well, you know, you've been staying there for a long damn time.
Right.
But, you know, I'm also not sure he's a politician. You know, you have to be super mega charismatic, and you have to raise a lot of money. And there's not, you know, that's a similarity between Canada and the United States, and mm-hmm. I'm not sure he can pull that off.
And I have to mention this because I saw this in the press report. Judy Sgro, of all people, threw her support late Wednesday to last-place contender Martha Hall Finlay. And she's bringing 12 undeclared delegates from her Toronto riding with her, and she's literally throwing them down the toilet. And she said she made her decision while watching the top four contenders and their chanting entourages enter the convention hall for the evening's formal kickoff, while Hall Finlay slipped in virtually unannounced. Sgro said, "Where's Martha? It's just not right. We need to stand with people who have courage and commitment." I shouldn't be laughing at that. I mean, she said, just because they don't have the big money and the big structure, you just can't ignore that. I don't know how to react to that. I think it's kind of funny. It's almost a futile gesture on her part. But
well, it's protest politics, but she gets her issues out. You know, she wants to see more women in politics. You know, it's good to sort of stick it to the Liberal machine, I think, a little bit.
Yeah,
because she knows she wasn't going to win, so you know it takes guts.
Good. All right. So it'll mean something. I mean, in the States, a gesture like that would not go off. It wouldn't even be reported hardly, or if it were, it would be laughed
that,
at.
Well, Howard Dean was up here speaking to the federal, and
right.
Don't forget Raging Cajun was speaking to the Ontario Liberals.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, right after the Democrats won their by-elections and the midterm elections, you know. Carvel, the Raging Cajun, was going for Dean's head.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Oh, we should fire Dean." I'm like, you know what? Carvel should shut up. He was great in the early 90s. But
right.
But at least Dean spoke for more than 18 minutes or whatever. So the Liberals apparently know how to spend money on American Democrats and get more time out of them federally than they do provincially.
Yeah, I would agree with you, and I think Carvel is grating on the nerves, and I think he's lost his edge with the public. To wrap up this topic, who do you think would be, for the Liberals, if there's an election next spring, who do you think would be their best shot at taking back control of 24 Sussex in Parliament? I know, I'm putting you on the spot. You want me to go first?
What do you got?
Okay, I actually think Ignatieff would be riding a dead horse on there, and I think he's beatable by Harper, as crazy as that sounds, in the long run. Give him enough time to screw up, and Harper would beat him. I fear the same thing with Bob Rae. I would say Dion, I think, is the best party leader for the Liberals right now if they want to reclaim the prime ministership next spring.
Maybe. I mean, I think so. Carry some baggage from, you know, being in from the old school, like, you know, all the old Liberal Party, and they're supposed to be, have new face and clean themselves up. And
they need people who can get things done, though.
Yeah, there's no question that he'd be a serious threat.
Mm-hmm. What would you say?
Well, he would also be a threat to the Greens, because he's very green, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd be a threat to the NDP. So in that sense, he would take some votes, and I agree with you there. I think Ignatieff could also pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, he supported the war, and he wouldn't be able to go up to the Tories so much for that.
Right.
Tough call.
All right, we can leave it at that.
Leave it at that for now. We'll have some polling numbers when it comes out.
All right. Well, as soon as this whole convention's over, we'll be back to pick it apart, as it were. Now, going on to the American side of the equation, could this mess that is currently going on with not only on the ground in Iraq, but the political mess of the Bush administration trying to solve this problem, could this get any worse?
It's always been humiliating, but now it's reached a sort of bizarre level of humiliating where they can't even spin it so it doesn't look like they fucked it up.
I mean, when you have...
The memo gets leaked, which you don't... You know, it's not a very leaked White House, so that memo got leaked.
The El-Maliki memo, which basically said he's ineffective and literally a joke as prime minister.
Right, so that, I mean, that wasn't some low-level guy that leaked that.
No.
So they leaked that, and then it bites him in the butt, and then, you know, then he refuses to show up for the meeting.
Right, for the dinner
in
Oman.
Bilateral talk, and then everybody has to run around safe-facing, oh, well, no, it's still okay. But that's not happening. Then, you know, people are beginning to call it a civil war, and Bush is still saying it's a... whatever he says, an insurgence amongst parties in the same area that disagree with each other, that, you know.
Right. And Bush was on CNN today saying, El-Maliki, he's my man. He's the right man for Iraq. I mean, he sounds like he's desperate and on crack when he looks at the camera and his eyes are bulging and he's gesticulating frantically. I mean, I think he might literally be losing it upstairs. How could any sane individual, I don't care if you are the President of the United States, look into a camera and mouth the words that he's mouthing right now? Colin Powell comes out and says, this is a civil war, let's call it a civil war. If I were in the administration, I would be calling it a civil war, which I would reply is why you're not in this administration.
Yeah, he says that. Kissinger says it's unwinnable.
Right.
Then, you know, CNBC or whatever, they finally got a out and say it's a civil war.
Right, they have.
And then, they're calling it who knows what.
And then you have the Iraq Study Group report coming out, I believe, tomorrow. That's basically going to urge a gradual but withdrawal to start. Non-specific, but, you know, with all one of these with all deliberate speed type deals. You know, this president has said, I'm not withdrawing the troops from Iraq.
Yeah, they all want, like, another try.
Mm-hmm.
Can we have another try, like, one more go, or no backsies?
Is it some sort of
playground game?
It's sort of like when Nixon bombed and invaded Cambodia. I mean, you know.
Thomas Friedman was like, well, you know, we should have another 150,000 troops. From where? You know, and, like, we haven't busted up enough whoop-ass on these people, and they're like, well, you know, we didn't try hard enough. Oh, we didn't try hard enough.
I don't know where they're going to get those troops from. And John McCain, of course, who would like to be next Republican president, has said the same thing. They can't, first of all, count on the United States forces have been stripped. Now you have to go to Korea and some other places around the world. It's too doggone tight. You can't do it. It's insane. What you have here right now is a growing civil war on the ground. You have al-Maliki, no matter how much lipstick you put on this pig, this man is a puppet president in charge of a puppet government. And as long as Uncle Sam stands behind this government with a big club in his hand, the Iraqi people are never going to respect it. The various factions that are now fighting and making Baghdad the bloodiest city in the world are not going to respect him. The United States has an option. They can go in with overwhelming force in a massive Gotterdammerung slaughter and sweep the streets of Baghdad, which, of course, would send the entire Arab world into an absolute fit. Or they can leave, let the civil war take their course, and heaven knows when the oil will flow from Baghdad, which, after all, is one of the main reasons the Americans are there and cannot leave.
Yeah, and now the new thing is to blame the Iraqis. Well, you know, they can't get their government together. Well, you know, you carpet bomb them, you demilitarize their military.
After starving them for 10 years.
Yeah, you destroy their infrastructure. You throw people together that are historical enemies that you helped fuel in the first place. And you're like, hey, how come this doesn't work?
Ungrateful bastards. Look at all we've done for them. And this is the thanks Uncle Sam gets.
I know.
Only Americans can think like this. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm an American. I want to be proud of my country. I want to love my country. But it just tries one's patience and credulity to see what is happening. And again, I'm not alone. There are a lot of people who voted in the last election who feel the same way I do and are demanding that the Democrats do something. The problem is, I think Bush has gotten this country and its military in so deep that this problem may be insoluble. I don't think
there are no good options. That it's like the drug war. There are no good options, and people that are looking around for good options, well, might as well pet and feed their little imaginary ponies.
I think
the choice is horrible option, terrible option, or slightly less terrible option.
I think the two options that the Americans have, I mean, they're trying to get, the Jordanians are trying to broker something with the Iranians and the Syrians, and the problem is that all those countries have their own vested interests. Both actually, Syria, and I heard of one of the Iraqi-American people on Lou Dobbs' show basically said, look, the Iranians want us to stay there and bleed. The Syrians want us to stay there and bleed, okay? That's what they want from us. Both options, either stay in and bring overwhelming force to bear or get out, both of them result in mass slaughter. Both of them. No matter how you look at it, there's going to be mass slaughter. No matter how you look at it, the United States is going to come out of this with the biggest black eye they may have ever had on the world stage. And we have...
Carter was saying in an interview that he thinks it's one of the worst decisions ever made by a president.
Absolutely. Jimmy Carter laid it right on the line. I mean, when he did lay it on the line. This all comes to the doorstep, again, of Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and the neocons who believed. And I've been thinking about this for so long. I really think that, again, although number one was to protect the oil, number two was to protect Israel's back door, but the third faction, they really believed in their heart of hearts.
That is this the rise of Jesus?
No, that if they went into Iraq, they could plant a democracy in the middle of the Arab world, and it would bloom, and it would take off, and spread democracy. I really think that they were delusional and demented enough to believe that you could do this with guns and tanks and bombs.
Yeah, the problem is they think wishing makes it so.
Yeah, they really do. They can create their own reality. Well, creating their own reality has worked real well, hasn't it?
Well, you know, Harper's Magazine a couple months ago had George McGovern's plans on how to get out of Iraq, and they're very interesting. He says, all right, we're spending $10 million an hour.
Right.
Let's do what we can do with that kind of money. And he makes a series of proposals, and I encourage people to check it out.
Yeah, that's
also
a good idea.
I want to suggest juancole.com.
Mm-hmm.
Informed comment. He's a professor in Middle Eastern Studies and Middle Eastern History and Religion, and he's president of the Global Affairs Institute. And every day he posts on his blog with some analysis of the Middle East, and it's usually 100 times better than you can get in the mainstream media. So
absolutely. Juan Cole rocks. Absolutely. Well, I guess we're out of time, and we haven't even scratched the surface. We took a little break. I was in Canada for a little vacation. Then I promptly came back and got a terrible flu, which I'm not going to call a Canadian flu, but we'll just leave it at that. So we had a little gap between shows. We'll try and follow up one right after the Liberal Party convention. But for now, we'll leave it at that.
That's all the time we have to solve the world's problems. And we'll be back next week with our own particular Canadian-American spin on the world. And I read the news today, oh boy.
All right. This is Keith Gottschalk from the Bleeding Heart of America.
And Matt Adams, who always interrupts you and who always forgets you're going to say you're from the Bleeding Heart of America.
Well, I'm sure you're very sorry.
I am very sorry, no doubt about that.
We'll see you next time on I Read the News Today.
The Christmas virus.